Okay, today we're going to discuss history. The first thing I want to start with maybe should be the last thing, which is to say that the classical curriculum, the more I looked at it, the more wonderful it is. Reading, writing, arithmetic, that's how you start. Then increasingly you do geography and history, because you can't do history without geography. And then you go into the arts and sciences. And you are really becoming a quite educated person by middle school. Now, they have stopped all that in our public schools because they don't teach you to read, so everything just stops. So bringing back history, bringing back geography, these are the two boss subjects 1,000 years ago. That's where you started. I read this wonderful quote from Cicero a couple weeks ago, quite by chance. Well, actually, I was reading about, Pompeii and Vesuvius and so on, and somewhere I think people kept going back to that site, you know, where Pompeii was, and they kept, every 50, 100 years, there'd be another volcano. Anyway, Cicero said, children or people who don't learn history are condemned to remain children forever. That's about it, because that leads to the perpetual, perennial childhood we see so much of in our society. We have millions of people without knowledge or thoughts or context, our understanding of anything. In a way, it's supposed to be good to live in the present, but not the kind of present where you just don't know anything else. You're living in the present by default. Now, as I say, you've got to know your geography because that's the stage on which everything occurs. You can't talk about a poem or an event anywhere in the world that somebody isn't going to say Indonesia or Japan or Northern South Korea or Iraq, and it's kind of foolish or fatuous, I guess is the correct word, to talk about what you know or don't know or what your thoughts are when you don't know where anything is. I mean, how many Americans can find North Korea on a map? Within 500 miles. Nothing too picky or too demanding. Just go ahead and point to where Korea probably is, and then, oh, North Korea, yeah, that'd be up here. They just aren't made to learn. One thing I always say, if schools have maps, it's probably going to be an okay school. A lot of schools deliberately got rid of maps. It's like getting rid of exercise. You know nuts are in charge. I'm sorry, but that's it. Children are like puppies. They've got to have exercise. And yet, at many schools around the country, you know, it's different fads sweep through different places, different times. But it was actually said by some of these horrible as infatuous administrators say, oh, we're just so busy with school and learning, we don't really have time to take a break. Nothing is going on in that school. Your kids are crazy with restless energy, for one thing. Okay, now another comical aspect of history and not teaching it is watching professors carry on about critical thinking, even as they try to destroy every step leading up to it. Traditional education gives you a logical progression to critical thinking. Without some background in all these fundamental subjects, I don't think you can have critical thinking, except as an empty phrase. If kids don't know the basics, the elemental knowledge that everyone should possess, what kind of serious conversation can you have? I mean, where is the Panama Canal, and why is it where it is? Now, if you can't just say instantly in 10 seconds, okay, it's there and it's there for these reasons, you just don't know anything. I'm sorry. It's not that you're a bad person. You're just an ignoramus. Now, one of my favorite sophistries, this can appear anywhere, but it's particularly popular in the area of history. And the sophistry goes like this. Since children can find every bit of knowledge on Google or the Internet, why bother learning anything in school? Now, I'd like to mention that 75 or 100 years ago, everything that was known to humanity was in our library down the street, or our families had enough money for a World Book Encyclopedia. It was in the encyclopedia down in the den. And all you had to do was go look at it. In some ways, an encyclopedia is much quicker than the Internet in some strange way, because you don't have to make any judgments. Google gives you two or three pages and all of which to an ignorant person might look like a good way to go. Think about that. I used to love, I don't want to overstate that too much because we'd have a basis for a Hollywood comedy, but I used to love the Columbia Desk Encyclopedia. It was a big, thick thing, and everything was in that book. It was only one book. It wasn't like the World Book and the Compton's and Britannica and so on. Absolutely marvelous, because you knew you were going to get 50 or 100 words. It was an encyclopedia beyond the dictionary. The dictionary, for a complicated word, they might give you 10 or 20, 30 words. The World Book would give you 100 or 200 or 300 or 400, depending on how important the subject it was. So you take 10 minutes, and then you know the whole subject in a loose way. In fact, what most people learn after going to college and majoring in something is probably only what you're going to get right up front from something like a Columbia Desk Encyclopedia. The last time I looked, which I have to tell you, several years ago, the World Book was on the Columbia Desk Encyclopedia had been posted on the internet. Now, whether it got enough activity or not, I don't know. The Wikipedia kind of jumped in and filled up. That's probably a left-wing plot to make sure that they can control the news. There is a competitor coming in against Wikipedia. Meanwhile, the Britannica was slow to wake up. They don't know how to compete against Wikipedia either. They have to do a better job and make it so this competition on the history block, so to speak. Well, I want to see memorization of things just for the sake of memorizing. This vendetta, this war against memorization is very sick. So you go to Siri and Siri tells you whatever you want to know. But you don't really own any information unless you can use it in conversation. Unless you can use it in debate. And it's really amazing. If somebody mentions Suez Canal in a conversation, the time it would take you to go and look up the Suez Canal, find it, and then make sense of it, it's going to be a minute, or 3 minutes, or 5 minutes, or 10 minutes. Well, you're not able to use that. You don't own that information. You're just pretending. There's nothing wrong with, just having a light, superficial thing, but let's look at that as the goal. That's just somewhere you hadn't done it very much. Now, here's another interesting thought about history. One way you know that history is valuable is our progressives try so strenuously to destroy it. These people want American culture to be a large, blank space in the heads of all the children. Cultural amnesia is another name for what they want. According to George Orwell, ignorance is strength. Our ignorance is the strength of dictators. I'm often struck by how brilliant Orwell is with his Animal Farm in 1984. And this tells you, his books tell you about the stupidity of communism and totalitarian. Now, this emptiness that liberals love to extol is to me the enemy of all Western civilization. And you notice that in 1984, Orwell had the governments updating the history each day. You know, in other words, what occurred on Monday is no longer the official history of that society on Wednesday. The Monday history is gone, in the memory hole, as it was called. Okay, now, having given some interesting subpoints, I want to just go back and make the big point as if I hadn't said anything. History is absolutely essential. The study of history is absolutely essential. And when you hear these second-rate progressive social manipulators, they call themselves social engineers, but I think social manipulators, they're schemers, and they're trying to always take away what people need. Knowledge is fun in itself, but it's also power. Facts are fun and knowledge is power. One of my favorite slogans. So I'm saying teach twice as much history as you now teach, or probably four times as much. Now this professor up at Notre Dame, Patrick Deneen, I think, he wrote a book about how kids don't know who won the Civil War. And I think Deneen was so shocked by this, he wrote a broadside, the kind of thing you just don't see very much. I write what I think are pretty aggressive articles, but I have to give Deneen credit. He outclassed me. He just rolled over this thing and said, the people behind this, he had nothing nice to say about anybody but our public schools. He says The funniest thing he said was that people are always complaining that the schools aren't doing their job. He says, no, they're doing exactly what they're intended to do, which is to keep everybody ignorant. Okay, that's kind of cute. Their malice toward history is apparently in a lot of states, history is taught as two separate courses up to the Civil War and then after the Civil War. And I can see where they're able to pass this because people remember it as being a lot. But that's the worst way to do it, because when you get to the second half, it'll be a year or 2 years later. You won't be able to remember it or fit it together. You talk to the average high school graduate today and say, what year was any particular event? They won't get it within 50 years. That's kind of sick. I knew a woman, just socially, who went to, I think... one of the most progressive colleges in California, and she majored in philosophy, and she could sketch out what Wittgenstein was talking about on a napkin. But I said, here's the problem. Her name was Siobhan, in case she's listening. She can say, oh, he's talking about me. Oh, my God. Siobhan, talking. We had a nice lunch at the Brasserie in Manhattan. And so she's telling me this and that and the other. And I said, look, Siobhan, you know, you're smart as you can be, and you know a lot. I mean, you know a lot of general stuff, but the truth of the matter is you're very uneducated about the basic facts. And she was shocked. I said, I'll prove it to you. She said, well, how do you do that? I said, tell me a single thing that happened in the 19th century, and I will retract all my criticism. So she looked around kind of wildly. Well, first of all, this is a trick question in this sense. These semi-educated people don't know which years are the 19th century and which years are the 20th century. Stop and think about that. You'll know what I mean. Because the 1700s are the 18th century. And this annoyed me, in fact, in high school until maybe in the 9th or 10th grade, some teacher explained it. Oh, I see. So I said, okay. Tell me one thing that occurred in the 19th century. And she looked around wildly, and she could not do it. Now, this is a gimme, because the War of 1812 is surely in the 19th century, and the name is a date. And furthermore, the Civil War is the most studied thing in our culture, and she doesn't know any of it. That means she didn't know the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln's presidency, or his death. All these things you might... Somewhere in your life, you might have learned one of these things. Not her. She just didn't know. But she was a very smart person. Because the whole point of history is to lead to critical thinking, and all that means is intelligent discussion. That's all it means. It doesn't mean a whole lot else. Did Japan do the right thing in 1941 to bomb Pearl Harbor, or was that the dumbest thing any country ever did? I mean, look, one thing that takes you into the kind of mysteries that history allows you to discuss is... On the morning of the first Battle of Bull Run, which would be 1861, if I'm correct, all the top people, I read this in different places, all the top people in both the North and the South thought it would be a quick war. Now, what were they thinking? What did they know or not know? People were supposedly educated. But let me tell you a fact of history you might not know. On that day, I think it's in the summer, it was hot, it was nice weather anyway, lots of rich people, wealthy people, came out in their carriages from Washington as though it was going to be an all-day picnic. And these carriages were parked on a ridge or an elevation so they could watch the presumed battle and watch the North win and drive these rebels, these Confederates, into the swamps of Virginia. They were that confident that they brought their children, their wives and children, and I guess their dogs and cats, out to watch the battle unfold. Now, this is so monumentally arrogant and stupid, you're just stunned to read about this. And what happened when the battle started to turn for the South, all of a sudden, here's all these, we call them swells, they don't use that word much anymore, but ladies and gentlemen from the upper classes, which I'm calling swells, that's usually a guy, but... These swells in their well-dressed outfits, their expensive clothes, they're suddenly in a state of panic. They're throwing stuff off the side of the road and whipping the horses and trying to get back to the safety of Washington, D.C., which I believe is only 10 miles away. They were in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Now, that's an exciting story. And so what were the Southerners thinking? What was their reason for thinking it would be easy? Okay, let's talk about the South. What were their reasons for thinking? Now, the average person today can't tell you anything because they don't learn any history. But these differences, the industrialness of the North, the tightness of it, the way they had the draft set up. Meanwhile, the guys in the South, because they had a lot more Northern boys, the Southern boys were much better fighters, much tougher. They grew up sleeping in the woods. You know, I mean, they go on hunting and camping trips with just routine. You rolled up a blanket and some food, pork and beans or whatever it is, and went out and lived out in the woods for 2 or 3 days. So that was nothing for them. And they were hardier, shall we say. And then, you know, they had a lot of arrogance down in the South. Not so much arrogance in the North, but apparently the leaders were arrogant. Humility is probably an advantageous trait in the survival of a human. Like they say, pride goeth before a fall. Well, the North and the South were equally proud. I mean, those Southern gentlemen that owned the plantations, you can see that in the war. See, what's the movie, Gone with the Wind? In general, what I think of is if we would just take care of the basics, which we could start doing tomorrow. Everybody knows this who's actually is sincerely trying to save the country and save the schools. They just have to get back at reading, writing, arithmetic, and then the history. And if you know your history, and you know your geography and your basics, then you're ready to go into science, and the whole thing will come into focus. You actually know what this world is you're moving through. Now, we don't know about the UFOs. We don't know about religion or God or divine spheres. People can't speak confidently, but our population can't even speak confidently about what happened 5 years ago all across Europe. Who is Stalin? Who's Hitler? My God, it's terrifying how ignorant everybody is. And another interesting proof of all this is you could show people a list of the major events, 6 or 7, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Civil War, Spanish-American War. Okay, let's just take 7 or 8 like that and say, all right, arrange those in orders, in order. No dates or anything, just get them in order. You'd be amazed. A lot of these students they cannot get anything within 500 miles on a map. And in terms of time, they can't get it within 50 years. I mean, seriously, it's kind of a joke. I've said this elsewhere, that you're in school for 30 hours a week, 30 weeks a year, a little bit over, 1,000 hours. In 1,000 hours, you can easily learn history. History is very important. It's fun to think about. I've got an article on the internet called Ergonomic History, or How to Teach History. It's on my main site. improve-education.org, and it's I think it's number 26, and it says the way you would do it. I'm going to just take the few seconds here to just do this. If I got to teach American history in a year, I would spend the first day giving them a total summary, the kind of thing you would get on a cruise ship or, you know, just the YMCA. Some guy's going to give you the whole thing, and I would put 4 lines across the blackboard, 1600, 1700, 1800, 1900, 2000, you know, starting with the starting with Columbus just before 1500, and then you'd say, block it out and say, okay, the colonial pirate, blah, 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 early thing, blah, 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 you know, colonial, and then the revolution and so on up to the Civil War and so on. And a few major inventions, like 1900 is a great year because that's when we first got our cars. The motors came a little before that, but just a bit. The first airplane in 1903, that's all because of the internal combustion engine, gasoline being readily available. So basically what we need in history is what we need through the rest of the school on every subject is everything systematic and well organized. Not just a chaotic jumble, which is what our public schools specialize in. I mean, it's like a bunch of drunk Romans at an orgy. They're just throwing, do a project. We'll do a project. But it can't be done that way. You don't want too much detail, but you want the main important things. I mean, the flow of world culture, starting in the Middle East, Babylonia and Assyria, some of these countries were amazingly advanced. Egypt was building the pyramids 2,000 years before Jesus, before the Christian era came. But I read a book about primitive engineering, and it talked about the cities, Babylon and Nineveh, I think. And they had these walls that were 25 feet thick and 40 feet tall. Now, you have to imagine what kind of enemy they're expecting, that they've got walls that you can drive chariot on the top of. The whole city is surrounded by a mile or two or three of wall. That's the way it was done in the old days. And then the new guys had to come with siege engines that were vast things. Oh, my God, you have to see a map. You have to see a diagram. What is it? There's soldiers inside of these things that are on wheels. And they have battering rams that are so they're protected. And the soldiers are up on the wall trying to kill the guys inside, and the guys inside are trying to swing the battering ram at the wall until they crack a hole in it. There's some fascinating stuff. I think everything is fascinating, but that may make me a little peculiar in our age now. But when we see the quiz shows, the one thing that has to strike everybody is how much people enjoy knowledge. It's not an eccentric thing or for nerds. Everybody enjoys saying, you know, when they ask these questions, who wants to be a millionaire, and the $64,000 question, and many, many versions of this. Oh, is that guy in a cab, and he's going to give you, you know, man in a cab? What was that called? It's something fascinating. Facts are fascinating. Information is fascinating. Things you don't know are fascinating. Or you will make a decision each time if it's too esoteric. Because real historian-type people, it's just like popular culture, you know. How many wives did so-and-so have, you know? And you say, wives did so-and-so have? That's not important. I mean, you know, some star, some movie star or something. You don't really care how many wives he had. It's more interesting if you say, how many children do you have, and did any of them become famous? And you say, oh, yeah, well, the third one, you know, became a rock star. That's interesting stuff. I think people are much more interested in this than the teachers like to pretend. The teachers, I don't think, are interested in anything. One of my bigger, more pessimistic theories is the people in control of our schools, they're much more, I used to describe them as, they're progressives, you know, lightweight socialists, but I realize more and more they're commies. And the thing about commies is that they're very limited to press people, but they just work all the time. They're busy. If you've got something in your school that works, they will try to outflank it, surround it, and destroy it. If people are learning to read, well, they'll put a stop to that. If children are memorizing the multiplication table, oh, well, you know, that's so old-fashioned. Stop doing that. I mean, they're just quite amazing people. So we've got fanatics in charge of history in schools, but they're fanatical about the wrong things. About not learning, about not mastering anything. So you're just wasting your time. It'd be better if the students became cabinet makers or pipe fitters. Or if you can work with a drill press. You can make amazing stuff I was a sculptor. He's a pure artist, but he worked only with power tools, so to speak. And he made the most beautiful things. I can't tell you his name. I was stunned. It was 10 or 15 years ago, I ran into him, and I thought, wow, that is something. And see, that's the kind of thing that you show to people, what's possible in each different area. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the conclusion here is history is important. Kids should do it. Try to support that when you have any influence on your schools. And learn history yourself and discuss it at lunch. You'll find that it's fun. Overview. Let's Fix Education explores 7 of my favorite themes. First, this podcast is a meditation on what I call the K-12 crime scene. So many destructive ideas. Understanding them is the key to fixing them. 2, by doing that, we will have better schools at less cost. 3, nothing much changes decade to decade. The big questions of the 1930s were the big questions of the 1960s and the 1990s. Any subject we discuss can easily intersect with any other subject. Most people instinctively want traditional education. but the education establishment fills classrooms with progressive gimmicks. The result is that we have a standoff, and that's why you run into the same ideas over and over. 4. The big brains in education keep telling students, don't bother memorizing this or that. You can look it up later. B.B. King, the great guitarist, is much smarter. He said, the beautiful thing about learning is nobody can take it away from you. 5. Lenin's ghost wanders through our school system. The hard left thinks big. If they have to kill millions of people to build their perfect society, that's okay. Same goes for dumbing down millions of students. Totalitarians want power. They will do anything to get it. 6. If we are going to survive, we have to take each child to his or her limit. As it is, we are creating millions of sub-educated students, from K right through college. 7. Analyzing education, especially dysfunctional education, is a lot more intellectually interesting than most people suppose. You'll enjoy this. Finally, P.S. My book, Saving K-12, runs parallel to everything discussed on this podcast. I also have an education site, improve-education.org, with 70 articles that complement everything discussed here. And I have hundreds of articles on the internet. Enter a topic in Google with my full name, Bruce Dietrich Price, and let Google make suggestions. Thank you for visiting.